Hi, everyone. Just a reminder that this show is not legal advice, trading advice, financial advice, or personal advice. Enjoy the show, and thank you very much. This show is sponsored by Inco, the world's first blockchain-based health tech financial solutions platform. Yo, yo, welcome to Crypto 101, the average consumer's guide to cryptocurrency. This is Matthew Aaron. You go to the store, you give them paper money, they give you goods. You take that paper money anywhere in your community, anywhere in your country, or you change that paper money for other paper money and go to different countries and buy goods with it. There's nobody there that can stop you and take your money from you, unless they rob you, but take your money from you or stop that transaction. There's nobody that's just going to cut in the middle between you and the grocer, you and the merchant, and say, no, you can't do this. But now that everything is online, everything is digital, companies can start, or governments can start stopping the internet service, putting blocks on what you're doing, how you're transacting. So this kind of thought led us to a simple question. Should transacting being buying goods with a currency, be all right? Well, it's kind of a loose question. It's kind of big and it's kind of broad. That's why this is a two-part episode, and we invited our old friend back, Hazem Al-Naqib, to help me talk about human rights, the blockchain, banking, and the future. So before we get into that conversation, please go to crypto101podcast.com, join our Facebook group, our Twitter, our Instagram to keep up to date, to join the conversation, become a Patreon. The Patreons are the backbone of our community. We appreciate your patronage. Check out our YouTube channel, Crypto 101 with Matthew Aaron. There we put previews and roundups to give you my own personal opinion on the episodes that we produce. Also, if you're not subscribed to us on iTunes, please subscribe to us on iTunes, CastBox, SoundCloud, or any other place you get your podcasts. And one more announcement. From now on, you're going to start seeing a little orange icon sometimes pop up in the Crypto 101 feed. That's ICO 101 with Aaron Paul, another great podcast from the Crypto 101 family. Now, without further ado, here's my conversation with Hazem. Hazem Al-Naqib, welcome back to Crypto 101, sir.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure to be back.
Hazem, what we want to talk about today is, first, I want everybody to know who you are. I think this is your third or fourth time on the show. So if you would, could you please just give a brief introduction of yourself?
Absolutely. So just to reiterate, it's an absolute pleasure to be back. It means either I'm doing something tremendously wrong or maybe slightly right that you're having me back over and over.
But well, you keep coming on the show. So you keep coming on the show, so we must be doing something right too.
of course. No, I love our conversations. But in general, background in banking, studied in Toronto, started a few different incubators and accelerators, got into blockchain and DLT and crypto and advanced technologies like AI. Currently, I sit on the board of several companies and maybe wear a couple of different hats between companies like Humani, CoinFirm, Currency, F6S, and a couple of other companies, as well as doing government and corporate advisory on different things. But a lot of it is how to leverage blockchain, distributed ledger technology, more broadly tokenization, asset tokenization, and applying these technologies in combination with things like artificial intelligence and biometrics and so on, and applying them to solving existing problems, be that wealth distribution, automation and process efficiency and management and so on, and various other areas, transparency could be things like land titles or health records and even identity. And I think a lot of it ties into many of the things we'll be talking about today, which are rights, which you and I may have some fun defining because it gets philosophical, so you can draw on your thesis work for that convo.
If I could remember, it was already 13 to 15 years ago. But what we are going to talk about today, and this is for the audience, I was having a conversation the other day with Tracy Leparulo, and we stumbled on something about the right to transact. And this was already down through a long rabbit hole, in my opinion, of talking about what is a human right. And me and Tracy were not prepared to have that conversation. But when we did say it, I thought, hey, I know who's going to have this conversation with me. And that's Hazen, because this is his.
You should have brought Tracy on, too. We would have the three of us sort of talking about it.
We could have. Maybe next time. She'll listen to it. She'll be like, you guys are totally wrong. She's gonna come up and tell us what's up. But what we want to do today is we want to just talk about a couple things, is basic human rights. I want to go then to the right to the internet, because that came up. It's a highly debated topic, people's right to internet access. Then one of your favorite topics, banking, the people's right to be a bank, have a bank account. And then it goes into, I would say, after that track of talking about the right to transact. What does it mean to transact? And, you know, back in the day, people would just, you know, take cash. You earn money, you get cash in your hand, and you transact with anybody you can basically meet. Of course, your circumference wasn't that far away. 5 miles is probably tops, but that circle expanded to globally now. What right does people have to put their money into the hands of somebody else for their liberty and their best interests? So, Hazen, let's start with basic human rights.
Okay, so there's a couple of different things just when I think trying to assess what is and is not a human right. So obviously there's tons and tons of international instruments globally, right? Obviously when looking at human rights, there are two ways you can go about it. There's obviously, there is some sort of higher up kind of these natural fundamental pillars of being a human being and being alive and interacting with people that creates different human rights. That's the idea of, you know, natural, either a natural law or you know, these different predispositions that are embedded in the foundations of a community. And these exist no matter what. They're like higher end constraints on humans or community behavior. So that's one way. The other way is forget that. Let's not look at that. It's just whatever is based on what's accepted by communities, by individuals in the community, or that's passed into law, et cetera, et cetera. That's more, as I'm sure you know, the kind of positivist approach. And the reason I'm going at it from a legal approach is because legal is just a manifestation. Before that, it is either what we agree and what we can observe based on consensus between people, communities, societies, and globally, or it is there are these overarching kind of principles that dictate and govern what we do, how we behave, and how we act. Now, to go down the legal route, because we can either talk about these are things that exist no matter what, or these are actually things codified in some way into law globally or by jurisdiction.
But I think that we should do both. I think that when we should look at law. Of course, let's not look at natural law, because again, those are there's moral principles of a community, as you said. But we should look at laws that are in and codified, but also the ways that they should change for the future. Because I was just looking, you know, one of the things that are being talked about in the United States, for example, right now, is the ability and the possibility with the new Supreme Court justice to overturn Roe v. Wade. Now, laws that do come up create consequences, and they can come up in the 70s from one legal perspective and then be overturned later. So I think that we should look at both.
Yeah, I agree. So what we can do is come at it from the angle of kind of moral overarching principles and then to the legal side. But the issue, the largest issue is obviously interpretation, because when we start looking at, you know, judges and what they do and so on, it's obviously open, not necessarily to the whims, but to the moral interpretation. If it is moral, it could be prudential, which is, you know, based on self-interest of a particular judge or legislator or whatever. But they have their own interpretation based on their experiences and so on and so forth, potentially of those overarching moral principles of how they interpret various moral principles that they think are required by that society at that particular point in time. And then there is what's actually brought into the legislative or the legal arena by precedent or by legislation or whatever else. So I think those are the three levels and three tiers. But just to start, I think at a global level, there are probably two different types of instruments, if I'm not mistaken. There are declarations and conventions, right? So declarations are not binding whatsoever. Conventions typically are, you know. So a declaration, an example of that is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the UN, you know, in, which was passed or agreed upon, I think, in 1948. in terms of conventions, there are lots of others. Probably one of the most notable is the European Convention on Human Rights, which we can get into a little bit later. And so there are lots of different instruments ranging from, you know, torture to human trafficking to so many other areas. But then even within human rights as well, there's the distinction between social rights and civil, right? Civil liberties, which is what you were talking about. So the way to break them up, I think, mentally is some have to do with social and economic, and some have to do with political. This would be a good way to break them down. A lot of what we see codified in law are usually those that are political as opposed to social and economic. And the reason why is because there's this continuous debate about bringing social and economic rights into the essentially foyer of the legislator. Why would we bring them into law? Civil liberties need to be protected by law and defined by law, but social and economic need to be handled by, you know, in some jurisdictions, the executive, for example, which creates policy on a particular platform that aims to protect it, you know, things like healthcare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, so on and so forth. But, you know, there are so many different opinions and ways of thinking about this. So I think from this standpoint, if we can get specific on the different rights that we want to talk about, which you did outline at the beginning, I think that will pave the way to digging deep into this. I think what I said is just laying the groundwork and the foundation for the best ways to think about it, be it the overarching moral principles, the difference between what is and ought, you know, what exists today based on consensus, based on, you know, soft law like declarations, what is law, conventions, how they're adhered to, what are the sanctions in case, you know, states or people break them, which people, it doesn't really apply. These are primarily for states and the legislation that they pass to protect individuals in their state, but also what ought to be, what things need to be changed, you know, should things be enforced a lot better or a lot more effectively? Should they be a lot more lenient to allow people to do what they want to do? When does somebody's freedom begin infringing on another individual's freedom or on the freedom of society at large to make certain decisions or to be protected from certain things? And I think that is the most important thing. That is the line that everybody needs to be focusing on. When does one person or one individual's freedom end and another person's begin? Is there overlap? What does that overlap look like? And then separately is what you were talking about, which is, well, there are certain principles that have developed over a long period of time that may well change very, very rapidly and very quickly in today's world, and perhaps what we can do about that, or how we should look at that, how should we assess, evaluate, and so on and so forth. And then maybe the last piece is, what are underlying, really embedded core moral principles that apply today in this changing technological world, where we need to expand them and extend them so that they cover a lot of the things that we're talking about. And you mentioned, sorry, this is quite a lengthy tangent, but you mentioned, you know, the right to transact and so on. But as far as I know, you know, the right to a bank account encompasses that. And so that, you know, digging as deep as we can into what exists will shed a lot of light, as well as how they're interpreted in different contexts. And I will build on this fundamental point later on when we start talking about other things that's on my mind. But for example, the right to have a bank account within the EU, that bank account need not, for example, be a savings account. You don't need to have the right to open a bank account if you have another bank account. You can be turned down if you don't meet the KYC AML requirements, but also you may not be able to do it because you have to pay an annual fee. That is accepted, but it must have the capability of being able to accept payments and make payments.
Right.
You know, that's on their website.
So looking at this, and I wanted to start at the Declaration of Human Rights, and I wanted to start there because it outlines some, I think, some fundamental beliefs that we all have. And also it creates a little bit of tension with some things that people are calling human rights. Anybody who is not familiar with it, the articles, for example, Article 3, would say everyone has the right to life, liberty, and the security of person. Article 4 would be no one shall be held in slavery or servitude. Going down to even, let's say, Article 13, everyone has the right to freedom of movement and residence within borders of a state, and the right to leave a country if they would like to. Of course, going to Article 14, the right to asylum. Now, these rights, I don't know how to say it, they're important. They're the difference between life and living a life that has meaning, or death, or becoming property yourself. One of the biggest criticisms to some of these, say, rights of economic rights or rights to banks and internet, is that how could we even start thinking that the right to internet should even be comparable to the freedom from slavery or persecution or the right to have residence?
So, as you know, what you're describing, it's not law, right? It's a declaration that's kind of right. It's guidelines for people to follow based on very commonly accepted human rights and so on. With regards to the majority of them, is that yes, individuals all have these rights, but more so, it's pressure on governments. That's the purpose of a lot of these instruments, right? It's all of the member states need to ensure that these rights are adhered to by the different government bodies, such that people have these rights in that jurisdiction. For example, the slavery and servitude piece is incredibly important for, let's say, human trafficking, some of the others for various other things, you know. But also, I think for anybody that's listening who really wants to dig deep into what rights are, you know, rights, duties, and obligations, they should look at Hofheldian analysis and how that analysis is conducted. I won't go into it now, but moving swiftly on, The point I would make about how to look at these is what type of obligation it puts onto the state, right? There's positive and there's negative obligations. So negative obligations are like the state should not kill its people, whereas positive obligations are like they need to, you know, put into law certain criminal sanctions for if an individual, a private citizen, kills another private citizen. I'm just giving examples, but that's how we should look at it, right? There are these positive and negative obligations that are placed on states, and that is incredibly evident by the European Convention on Human Rights, right? So that is how that operates. And the reason I use that example is because there's an actual court in Strasbourg where cases are taken, right, on member states of the European Council. It's not the EU, it's the European Council. Now, back to your point about why is this as important as, like, access to the internet and so on. I don't know if I would say personally that it is, but I think that socially and at a community level, you can draw comparisons because access to the internet, as we become more and more globalized, where information becomes promulgated, you know, instantaneously, it becomes part of an individual's freedom of expression, being able to access information, being able to access knowledge, being able to voice themselves and so on. And actually, there are cases, if I'm not mistaken, that have been taken to Strasbourg. So as part of the European Convention on Human Rights, but when I say Strasbourg, I mean the court in Strasbourg that essentially enforces and that cases are taken to, where a country, it may have been Turkey, where they had not allowed access to Google, and they were found guilty of a violation of an article of the European Convention on Human Rights. So I think it is getting there. It may not be widely accepted that it is at the same level globally, but, you know, you could say the same thing about, let's say, torture or degrading treatment. You know what I mean? Degrading treatment arguably could be, you know, a police officer slaps an individual on the face and makes them feel really afraid and demeans them. You know, that is, you know, that cannot be derogated from ever with the European Convention on Human Rights. Again, the reason I use it is because it's enforced, right? There are sanctions tied to it. It isn't everybody does what they want. There is a margin of appreciation that allows a state to do what they need to do. There's this kind of like deference by the court, but not always, you know, it depends on the topic and so on and so forth. So yeah, I would say, look, it comes down to freedom of expression. That's what you're describing. Mm-hmm. And so it depends, do we tie or place an importance on freedom of expression at the same level as not being held in servitude and so on? And I would say yes, you know, freedom of expression is about the pursuit of truth, mm-hmm. And being able to voice oneself about literally anything. And I would even go further and say that freedom of expression, as well as, you know, not being trafficked or held in servitude, not being killed and so on and so forth, once you encapsulate it as freedom of expression, in my opinion, it does get to the same level. If not, then probably not, because obviously it's not a protected right. But once you do that, it becomes part of the self-determination of an individual or a people. Now, self-determination, for those that are listening, is a very interesting, I think, doctrine, where every set of people, this applies to groups of people, you know, have the the right to their, you know, to determine their political, social, and cultural future. It typically refers to groups of people when they're in pursuit of creating their own state. That is usually where this doctrine is used in international law. However, I would, you know, extend that also to the individual in being able to determine their own future as part of the community. There are different levels and tiers. It is their right to participate in the community's self-determination to determine their cultural, social, and political future. And if that is the case, access to knowledge, being able to voice themselves, so on and so forth, as part of freedom of expression, is incredibly fundamental.
Thank you for that thought. I think that you touched on a lot of amazing things, and I think that brought us straight into that the internet would be a human right, or is considered a human right, or being talked about as a human right by the UN. And one of the points that you brought up is the freedom of expression, the freedom of speech, freedom of communication. These are important tools in any kind of, you know, free government, free democracy, is to be able to express your opinions. And and the reason why I brought up the Declaration of Human Rights, even though it is a guideline for countries to use as a framework, an outline for them to, you know, make sure that, you know, the people that live within their borders are being treated as fairly as possible, even though their, you know, culture, morals, and so on and so forth that they look at while making their laws, it's a really good place to start, because then we can start understanding what these fundamental ideas, and you might call them natural law, of morality and upholding people's dignity, that we should have a starting point. And when you say freedom of speech, expression, communication, this goes to liberty, this goes to Article 3, and also we're understanding how the internet falls into that. So I really appreciate that. And self-determination as well. So now we have the internet in there. Internet as being a human right, because we have now defined it as expression, communication, or speech. Correct?
Yeah, definitely. So,
And now a word from our sponsor, Anko. Hey everyone, I want to let you know about Anko. Anko is the world's first blockchain-based health tech financial solution platform. Health tech is new in solutions in overcoming evolutionary challenges, diseases, disabilities, and longevity of life. Blockchain health tech will drive development in diagnostics, treatment, and research. Anko has been created to deliver health tech innovations to the forefront of society. Anko's platform will deliver high-impact projects. They will be supported by an ecosystem infrastructure via their blockchain platform. All of this is possible through the utility of digital financing, health tech, and evolving ledger-based technologies. Anko's platform will deliver Anko's own blockchain that will unite health tech projects with three further pillars of applications: Anko IB, Prime, and Smart Cap Solutions. To drive the next stage of human evolution, Anko is dedicated to building an innovative ecosystem, which they created an environment based on trust, integrity, and openness. If you're interested in their token presale, which starts on July 27th, go to encoin.com. That's encoin.com, and contribute in the first 24 hours of the token presale to enjoy up to 55% bonus AEN tokens. Again, that's encoin.com to register. Now, back to our show.
So just to clarify one point that you said, natural law is referring to something very, very specific. It's talking about, and I didn't clarify this earlier, natural law is more about, you know, the foundation of law and its purpose and so on and so forth is dependent on these kind of overarching moral principles, as opposed to, you know, what human beings do and solely based on social facts and consensus. No, it's reason and purpose is driven by overarching moral principles. So I'm just extending that thought to apply elsewhere. And my heavy focus on law is because what law provides is, and what we mean by law, I want to extend that point, is that non-compliance results in some sort of sanction. It need not, but there is an understanding that one must comply, essentially. Be it an individual, a state, or so on and so forth. And with the declarations, the guidelines, you know, as well as with conventions, a lot of these are more, you know, soft law instruments. But in international law, they can still turn into law, okay? So they turn into customary international law by two factors. And those two factors are state practice and opinio iuris. State practice is more about the behavior and the consensus of states. I'm talking at the state level. And then opinio iuris is the intention that it is essentially international or customary international law. So that's the funny thing about international law, which is a little bit different. You know, you don't have a legislator just pushing it out. You have the International Court of Justice, but which perhaps sometimes isn't as clear, but it does a great job at landscaping what the current law is internationally. Mm-hmm. But moving from there, the reason I focus on Strasbourg and the European Court of Human Rights and the European Convention on Human Rights is because, if I'm not mistaken, this is the court that probably hears the most cases globally on issues of human rights. So if somebody wants to, and what that goes and does is it means that those rights that you and I are talking about become so much more fleshed out. You know what I mean? They have context and content. They have substance because they have gone through so many iterations of so many different cases of so many everything. So then they become a lot clearer and a lot more crystallized. Not to say that mistakes aren't done and, you know, sometimes they're a little bit weird and off, and I can think of a few examples, but as a whole, there is progress and progression and this evolution of what it is and what they mean. Because if you and I just say freedom of expression, we can literally extend that to probably anything if we really tried hard enough, right?
It's true.
So that's why this is a good thing. So when I say that it's a good thing to use Strasbourg as an example, because they've had so many different cases, and we're like, it's insane how many cases that they've had over the last several years across a range of issues, you know, including discrimination, for example, where there's now flesh has been added to the bones, and we can really understand it contextually. It doesn't apply everywhere. It only applies to the members of the European Council, but it gives us an even stronger starting point if we want to understand it, instead of starting with just, you know, moral principles very far away. But the way and the reason why it's important then for individuals like yourself and many of the listeners to then engage with moral principles is because it allows, you know, overarching moral principles is because then it allows them to see the difference between what is and ought that you mentioned earlier. You know, what exists today, what ought to exist in the future. And that will give them, I think, the best perspective in knowing what human rights are, what they should be, and how things should develop. I apologize. I feel like I didn't answer to your question. So if you could please ask me it again.
No. I don't think there's questions and answers. I think this is a conversation because, perfectly honest, I don't know where this conversation is going to go, and I don't know what you're going to say. Honestly, I don't know what I'm going to say. But what I think is important to understand from the listener's point of view is the reason why I'm asking these questions the way that I am is that we can't have something become a human right without understanding the human rights. And I'm really happy that you brought up the European Court of Human Rights. I also think that once you say the internet is a human right, then fine, that's great. But then you have banking and banking the unbanked. And now those global transactions, those transactions are happening over the internet. So if you don't have a free internet or the idea of the internet, and we frame that as the internet being a human right, then how does banking work with something that might be controlled by either corporations or a government or what have you? And then we're going to talk about transacting. So I think that's why I went to the internet first before anything else.
Yeah, I need to clarify an important point. So I agree with certain parts that you said, but I'd like to clarify one point, and that's because we're conflating two things. The internet, a fundamental human right, is it a fundamental human right by law? Is it a fundamental human right by extending freedom of expression? And I know I mentioned earlier that it is according to, you know, the court in Strasbourg. But what that was about, if I'm not mistaken, and the case law around that was actually primarily around the state blocking access to certain websites like Google and various others. And there are other examples of that and so on and so forth. But it's very different, right? It goes back to the positive and negative obligations that are placed on a state. It is the state itself taking a particular action that blocks a particular outcome or course of action by an individual, which is, you know, either publishing material, promulgating material, being able to search for things online, things like that, you know, and when things are blocked. Now, just bare minimum access to the internet, that is not yet a human right, you know? Mm-hmm. So right. I don't think, as far as I know, that there is any case law in the world. I could be mistaken, and this is something I would need to look up. And if any of our listeners know, please send it to myself and Matt. But as far as I know, there is nothing that's codified or even soft law that says that every individual should have access to the internet. There's a lot of people trying, and obviously it's part of, you know,
I think that there's been two expansions with this. And again, please, the listeners, correct me if I'm wrong. From a piece that The Guardian did over the past year, they talked about different countries ratifying and making that internet access should be a human right, Estonia being one of those. And I really want to...
Yes, correct.
That is access. And the other one is of course, what the United States is dealing with right now. And I think the EU has already dealt with it, is not allowing the commerce, the institutions, or the companies, the ability to manipulate the content of the internet into their favor. And that's not just access or speed or what have you. That is putting stuff at the forefront or signing exclusivity contracts with X companies. So you're only using, say, you're only seeing ads for Coca-Cola and Pepsi's on the back shelf. And I think that they called it in The Guardian's piece, shelfifying or grocerifying the internet, as say, for example, you would pay the most money to be on the middle shelf in the middle row if you're Coca-Cola, and the people in the companies that are on the bottom or on the top shelf are paying less money for, you know, strategic placement.
Yeah. So going back to what you said, yeah, my point was that there's nothing at an international level.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
That says access to internet. No worries at all. Yeah. No, you were right though about Estonia. And I believe there's a few other places. There are several international initiatives that are solely focused on that, funded by a lot of larger intergovernmental agencies, NGOs, and so on, that are pushing for this and pushing for access to the internet to be a fundamental human right. And the same thing with, you know, for example, identity. I believe it's, if I'm not mistaken, Article 6 of the Declaration on Human Rights that says, you know, it's something like everybody has the right to recognition as an individual and or as a person before the law. Correct me if I got the words mixed up. But also the sustainability goes, the sustainable development goes, then go on to build on providing legal identity to everybody, right? And so that includes the right to have an identity. What that means, and that can be extended to having, you know, for example, a digital identity. And that goes to the, you know, the over 1 billion. So there are some reports that put it between 1 and 2 billion, 1 and 3 billion, slightly under a billion of undocumented people, and providing them with digital identities, as well as many of the refugees globally, providing them with digital
crazy
identities. And them having the right to have an identity, whether it's digital or not, right? Mm-hmm. But the language that's used can be extended there, and I truly believe that it should, right? Having an identity, allowing, being able to passport, being, you know, legally real, right? That is literally what we're talking about. Being real in front of the law mm-hmm. requires you to have an identity. If you don't, all these people are undocumented. This is something Humanique is tackling with, you know, the unbanked, but also undocumented. It provides a digital identity to people, but also several other initiatives, many other initiatives that are aimed around this. A fantastic organization is ID 2020 that is aimed at getting everybody who doesn't have an identity a digital identity. And that digital identity then provides them access to different things, right? If you think about it, you essentially need a digital identity to do anything. Right? All of your info is tied together in one way or another.
Right.
To get a bank account, you need an identity to some degree, to do X, to do Y, and so on. So when we start talking about bank accounts, the interesting flip side to that is, well, open a bank account, it requires you to have a certain level of identity. There are different degrees and so on, but let's say you need to be legally recognized as being a person based on certain documentation that you have, digital or not. Therefore, if everybody has the right to do that, if they meet certain requirements, if they don't meet those requirements, they're not entitled to a bank account. Well, does that now mean that they have the right to pursue those requirements, including identity and having an identity, and tying that with Article 6 and the of the Declaration on Human Rights and the Sustainable Development Goals and so on, to enable people to have the right to an identity, essentially, which I think the case should incredibly easily be made for it. But in practice and in implementation, it of course becomes very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. And that I think is the where the real issue comes in. A lot of it is about implementation, right? Are things practical and so on and so forth? And that is more of a question, at least from the standpoint of a lot of companies as well as governments. Well, when the technology reaches a certain level, we can go out and do it as opposed to individuals coming to us and getting, you know, X, Y, and Z, because now you can just promulgate it if they have access to the internet and access to the identity. You go through the internet to get them their digital identity, which right. enables them to get the bank account, right? So no, they're really all tied together as yep. As elements of living a life in today's world and being an interconnected participant in both local and global markets, but also just having the right and having access to all of these things. And you use this word quite a bit, and I agree with it. A lot of it is about access, right? It's not the right to a thing. It's the right to be able to pursue it without any barriers or hindrances placed in your way that prevent you from it. So that is also how I look at these things.
So let's go into banking the unbanked, the right to a bank account, and what does that mean, the processes of doing that. We've already said how, and you said it perfectly, I wish I said it so perfectly before, we could have saved probably 20 minutes of this conversation. Everything is tied together. We saw human rights and the internet and identity and everything, but we're still trying to get to transacting. Let's talk about banks first. How do they get these people without identification, without a person under the law, like you said, get a bank account? Do we first have to give them an ID? And then what I think we're seeing here is the KYC AML. People need to have this to get a bank account. Is this something that should be done, that you have to provide all of this? I think why do I ask this? Is because now we have to talk about, is banking, is transacting a human right? And not just a human right as, say, as a declaration, but everybody has the fundamental ability to transact because it's their liberty, the right to pursue happiness. Happiness is a form of wealth. Happiness is a form of occupation or any other way you want to put it. And transacting is a way of doing that. If you're not using cash, how are you doing that? And people are going digital across borders, across towns, across cities, across states. Now, I mentioned this, the KYC AML, is because I thought Puerto Rico was a very good example of what happened over there with the hurricane. Insurance companies come in and they need to pay out insurance for houses that were blown away. The government needs to reimburse people for houses that were blown away or losses to, you know, property. Most of these people were in makeshift houses, undeclared, unregistered, no address. And this is just some loopholes in the law. You have people that are, say, in makeshift houses, makeshift communities, makeshift cities without an identity or even without a proper address. And you can't get reimbursed by governments for natural disasters. So this goes mm-hmm. into banking. This goes into how much control should a government have or the law have to allow people to do something that maybe we'll decide is a basic human right.
Yeah, so you always take us down this direction about how much power the government or the regulators and legislators should have. But I agree with you. No, it's okay. I agree with you in the sense that it's an incredibly nuanced question, and also really, you know, even if we agree that you know, X is a fundamental human right, that still needs to be codified, or there needs to be international law instruments that require member states or signatories to bring it into domestic law, which is obviously, you know, it's still a long shot. But again, we're talking about, you know, what ought to be. You began with the KYC and AML and all of that stuff. Well, right now in the EU, like we mentioned earlier, you have the right to a bank account. The bank account must be able, in terms of capability, to allow you to accept payments and make payments. That's what we're referring to by transacting, right? To define it just very simply, you can make payments and you can receive payments, essentially. As of right now, you obviously need the right documentation with the majority of banks, if you look in Africa or elsewhere. And if you don't, then you're usually put into a database where of you know, your contact info, if you have it, is stored and you've been rejected. You can be rejected for various reasons, one of which is not completing the appropriate KYC. But there are, you know, there are many different solutions that have emerged over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years for those either without the capacity for funds or without the right documentation, which create, you know, micro momentary bank accounts, for example. Mm-hmm. Some telecoms have done this, which allow you, let's say, to pay for things using data and so on and so forth. I don't know the specifics, but there are a lot of solutions, be it for cross-border remittances or just for making very quick and easy payments and stuff like that. So solutions are emerging that take advantage of existing infrastructure. Obviously, a solution is Humanique, which is beginning to emerge, which is primarily focused around using a token, let's say, and conducting KYC in the sense of just, you know, photo, password, facial recognition, and so on, so that it is really your identity. And then based on that, gives you access to a mobile wallet. And that mobile wallet is essentially your account. And that's where you store. As things continue to get more developed over the next several years, where you have, you know, fiat currencies on the blockchain, or you have various, you know, side chains that allow you to move currency around from different networks and so on, as well as different banking products and services brought onto a blockchain network or a network of networks, right? It would be more comparative and competitive. So right now you can pay for things if you want to and if it's accepted. But if it's not accepted or it's regulated against, then that completely removes this option and this possibility. And why would it be banned? Well, it would be banned for various reasons. It's too volatile. It's competing with, you know, the local currency. It is enhancing potential money laundering and so on and so forth. Now you went into AML. Just to highlight AML, because I think I've covered KYC very briefly. There are a lot of components and elements that go into KYC, know your customer and stuff like that. But that's a decent overview. The AML side is a little bit different. I think a lot of people conflate AML and KYC, AML being anti-money laundering and CTF, which is counterterrorism financing. The thing with AML is we need to know where the funds came from. Okay, so KYC is about the individual, where the individuals the money came from, and having the right documentation, identity verification, and so on, and potentially authenticating that info and verifying it against, let's say, you know, different databases like Interpol and so on and so forth. There are different levels of extensivity at which it can be. With regards to money laundering, it's actually, you know, those funds, you know, you go and you deposit money into an account, or you put it into your crypto wallet, and then you want to put that money into an account. What's in terms of AML, where did that money come from? Who contributed it, you know, if you're selling something, so on and so forth. And the reason this is interesting is because obviously what cryptocurrencies provide is a certain level of anonymity. It isn't complete anonymity because, you know, we know your address, right? So I'm on the board of advisors of a company called CoinFirm that does this for cryptocurrencies, and they're completely blockchain agnostic. They're one of the top leading companies in the world that does this and conducts, you know, forensics and basically checks on the wallet and on the tokens, right? You know, you can trace a Bitcoin throughout the public blockchain, right? And you can go through, you know, different wallets and so on and so forth and conduct analysis and see whether it's been used, you know, in the dark web and stuff like that, what it has been used for, if that wallet is present there and so on. But there have been reports with regards to, let's say, Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general, that the money laundering percentage is actually very, very low. But it makes organizations, regulators, governments, and companies very hesitant to be able to accept it or interact with it for various reasons, including the fact that it's, you know, many of them are not treated as currencies per se, but because they don't know who it is or where it came from and things like that. So this goes to your point, like, do we have, and you mentioned earlier, do we have the right to complete anonymity? Well, anonymity is never going to be complete. And actually, there needs to be these controls, mechanisms, and precautions put into place to ensure that, you know, you're not financing criminal activity, your funds are not the illicit proceeds of criminal activity, and so on and so forth. That these new developing platforms that have the potential for a lot of good are not either sabotaged or hijacked or taken advantage of, and various loopholes are provided for moving money around and the proceeds of illicit whatever activities and so on, because there will always be bad actors. And so I think certain controls should be put in place so that the real potential benefits the right people. And actually, like I had said before, there are reports that show it's actually tremendously low. It's much lower than in the traditional space where there is a lot of money laundering. You know, the traditional, you know, money in a briefcase being moved around, as opposed to on different blockchain networks, some being more anonymous than others. But at the same time, it's not fully anonymous. And actually, it's quite a bad idea for these bad actors to be using a blockchain network to do anything that they're trying to do. So yeah, I also went a slightly different direction, but I think those are important pieces to take into account when looking specifically at, well, we should be able to have a bank account. Everybody should be able to have access to a bank account, no matter what, even if they don't have the right KYC and AML. So what I would say to that is, it depends obviously what. It depends, are we talking about a crypto wallet or so on? Are we talking about a digital identity or a regular identity? All of these different components and pieces are still unclear, and a lot of it requires on adoption by local governments and local regulators and institutions having buy-in and saying, yes, I want to be able to accept that. Yes, we're okay with that. But go back one more point to the conclusion that you came to earlier, all of it is about access, right? It's not saying that everybody has to have this bank account. No, everybody has to have access to a bank account if they meet certain requirements that are made inherently easy for them, right? Like a digital identity that anybody can put together if they're undocumented, right? It's if they are undocumented, we will provide them with a streamlined process to get a digital identity that has government buy-in, which the banks then accept as part of creating a bank account. And they will also accept, let's say, the DLT or blockchain wallet and the crypto that they've been storing, you know, because we need to have streamlined processes, and that requires buy-in from all stakeholders, be it NGOs, governments, regulators, banks, telecom companies. And we need these, you know, innovative startups like Humaneek and CoinFirm and many others that are driving that charge forward and almost, you know, lighting the first candle. That's how I look at it, right? Because it provides capability, and that capability then makes it easier for everybody else who can do these things without high expenses. Because what is the reason why banks don't go out and service the unbanked and the undocumented? It's because it's too expensive per person. It doesn't make sense from a bottom line profit standpoint for them.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Crypto 101. This is the first part of a two-part episode with Hazm talking about blockchain, transactions, human rights, and the future of technology and what we should start protecting. We need to have this conversation now before legislation and laws are made that restrict us in ways that maybe cash would never be able to. Pay attention to the Crypto 101 feed wherever you get your podcasts for part two. And as always, ApogeeCrypto.com, the best place to check your real-time prices, CryptoNews.com for your news, WPOnTheFly.co for a website, and we'll see you in part two. Thank you very much. This is Matthew Aaron.